Can you imagine selling a house for £20 million? Well, for our next guest today, you can take that number and times it by 10. Gary Hersham is the go-to estate agent for the super rich. Having famously sold a residential property in central London for over £200 million, Gary has quite literally seen it all. From sheikhs and sultans to oligarchs and aristocrats, Gary knows almost everyone of importance, not just in London, but New York, the Middle East, and beyond. He has a relentless and fiery energy, a charming candidness, and a totally unique style. This is a cracking episode, so sit back, relax, and we hope you enjoy it.
Getting money.
One for the money.
$350 Swiss.
Zurich, 23.
Two for the show.
Two and eight sold.
Get it, get ready, and board up.
Go!
Welcome to Mavericks.
Gary, I've heard your phone doesn't stop, so let's go fast.
I've turned it on silent.
It's very kind, thank you. You grew up on Avenue Road in St. John's Wood. Your late father was chairman of three public companies. You have a degree in theology, a degree in zoology, biochemistry and entomology, a PhD from the Royal Postgraduate School of Medicine.
I don't have a PhD. I started my PhD.
Two and a half degrees. I do know this. I'll come back to this in a second. You're admittedly a shy young man. It's not necessarily the background I was expecting from the UK's most accomplished estate agent. Do you want to tell me a little bit about your early life?
I lived at home with my parents. And we had a very happy childhood.
Fantastic. I think maybe one of the obvious places to start here is that career-defining potentially moment in 1977 with your friend Eric Pereira, the high tea you had. Do you want to tell me a little bit about that and kind of what led up to that point?
Remind me which year, please.
77, I think. High tea with your friend Eric Pereira.
Okay, so in 1977, I would have been 24 years old, which meant I had finished undergraduate, postgrad from theology, and I had started to work for my late father in one of the divisions of his company, the property division of his company. My late father, besides being a very nice and intellectually intelligent man, was a bit of a tyrant, if not a great tyrant, and I found it quite difficult to work for him. A friend of mine, Eric Pereira, came to tea on a Sunday afternoon, I believe. We used to have high teas every Sunday afternoon, and 6 o'clock in the evening, table laid out with a full variety of sandwiches, cakes, whatever. And he said, "Look, I've just bought a small estate agency. It's called Scott Gilroy." But I found out that David Scott Gilroy ran away with clients' deposits, so we've had to change the name. I didn't buy the business, I just bought the name. Had to change the name. We've changed it to Beecham Estates because we're at 14 Beecham Place. "Do you fancy joining us?" And at that very moment, if I spontaneously said, "Yes, I will." I started with him in that year at Beecham Estates at 14 Beecham Place.
With your father's blessing or not?
In my father's blessing, of course. But I couldn't have done anything without my parents' blessings. I think it might have been in early January. I think it might have been, I thought we might have had that auspicious tea in the early part of the year, because by the end of June or July, he told me, "Look, I've got to go. My father runs a rather large university business in Singapore. He's not very well, and I've got to go and help run the business. If you can find some..." And I put in £2,000 of loan, my late father put in £2,000 of loan capital. And he said, "If you can find somebody to invest £10,000 in the business, they can have 50% of business and you can bring your shareholding up from 20% to 50% and I'll pay you your money back."
Which I think inflation adjusted is about £75,000, £80,000 today. In and around that region.
Don't scare me. Did I ask my father for that amount of money those days? No, I don't think I don't think it's terribly relevant because I don't think that amount of money. Anyway, let's leave that aside for a moment. We did so. I brought a chap in called Joey Esfandi, and you can look him up. He runs a company called Dwyer PLC. Joey put in 10,000 quid. I owned 50%. He owned 50%. By December or so, Joey said, how much of that money's left? I've had enough of all this. How much of that money's left? By memory, I think £9,200 was left. Give it to me. I gave Joey the £9,200, and I owned 100% of the business. And that was the start of Beecham Estate's proper career.
And I suppose at this stage, I can't imagine that super prime was the area that you were focused on. How did it begin? Rentals, sales?
My late father was chairman of a public company, as we've just spoken about, and he introduced me to various people in the public company world. And as such, I met English buyers who were buying what was prime and is now super prime for very much less money than they're paying today. And I did two or three deals, one of whom was with the famous Gerald Ratner. How come Gerald Ratner? Because I used to go out with Gerald's sister Denise. Dealt with her for several years, and Gerald bought a house from us in Arlington Street, all those years ago, and so on and so forth. And then certain things happened, and I was introduced to a very wealthy German who lived in Grosvenor Square, and he asked me to sell his two flats in Grosvenor Square, which I did, and I bought him a house, or maybe even two houses in Tregunta Road. Then our next door neighbours at Avenue Road were Kuwaiti, late Suad Al-Humevi, and she asked me to help find houses for her, and I found houses for her. And then somehow I met a chap called Hassan Swalem, and Hassan Swalem was the right-hand man of Princess Moody bint Mansour bin Abdulaziz Al-Saud. So I met Amir Amoudi bint Mansour bin Abdulaziz Al Saud, and I sold her, believe it or not, the whole of the first floor of Porchester Gate, window to window, from side to side. It was a six-bedroom, six-bathroom, three-reception-room, staff bedroom and bathroom flat, £280,000, fully furnished, refurbished, and it was done by a chap called Paolo Tessai. Paolo Tessai is in his early 80s today, and we're still very good friends. I'm going back to the late 70s or the early 80s.
Incredible. How I suppose, yeah, a lot of the people you're talking there, very successful, very wealthy. How did you gain the trust of these people fairly quickly? What do you think is a character thing? Why do you think you've been so successful in building?
Come on, you're asking me a question about what happened 50-odd years ago. I would never even have thought about it that way 50 years ago. Not only that, but I was myself. I acted myself. I didn't play any games. I wasn't frightened of that sort of world because my father, we lived in quite a substantial house in Avenue Road. In fact, if we go past 46 Avenue Road today, you'll just see the facade there that my late father built. They've knocked the whole thing down. They're rebuilding it as we speak. It's all very natural to me. Never been worried or scared about dealing with high net worth individuals or chairmen of public companies because many of them came to our home for supper.
Yeah. Amazing. I think what's interesting, one of the questions I had for you is that having met hundreds of incredibly wealthy people from all backgrounds, how do you sniff out success in your line of work?
What do you mean sniff out success? What does that mean?
I imagine wealth is continuously transferring different sectors, different geographies, etc. And you've got to keep up with those changes. Maybe, you know, the last few years you had a lot of tech, hugely wealthy tech entrepreneurs, etc.
There was something called Google. And if somebody comes to me and he says, I want to spend X millions of pounds on a home, the first thing a decent estate agent does is does a Google search. Can't find the person. You ask them to get their lawyer to provide a letter confirming that they do have the ability to spend whatever the amount of money is. But generally speaking, you don't need to go that far. you can do a Google search on whoever it might be. There's not sniffing out. It's pretty much obvious and in the public domain.
And I suppose nowadays a lot of your business comes from word of mouth and reputation. Did that differ from the early days?
Not really. In the early days, we were very, very, very small fry compared to the Knight Franks and Savills who were around at the time, and Hamptons and Chestertons who were around at the time. In the early days, we sold, for example, a house to Khalifa bin Zayed, the Crown Prince of the Emirates. I think it was number 17 or 19 Upper Brother Street, and I'm almost sure the family still retains it. And I think he paid about 1.3 million for it. And I suspect today, I can't remember the exact size, but I suspect today, if it was in perfect order, if it was around 20,000 square feet or 25,000 square feet with the mews, it would be worth no less than 100 million pounds. I then sold the late Azil Nadir, and if you remember Polly Peck, Polly Peck was, well, your viewers can check what Polly Peck is or what Polly Peck was. And I sold at Azil Nadir a house. In fact, I sold it to his wife, Aisha Nadir. Most spectacular house. Number, probably 19 Eaton Place. Try to remember precisely, it was 21 Eaton Place. I think they paid £900,000 for it, maybe £800,000. God, it disturbs me. My memory isn't perfect. And again, a house like that with a mews going all the way back to the mews, probably 12,000-13,000 square feet today, probably worth 50 odd million quid today.
Wow, incredible. Do you, over the years, do you become friends with clients? Do you get to know their families, etc.? Or is it strictly business?
Let's actually talk about today rather than over the years. If I'm dealing with a client myself or an applicant myself, we have two different words that define who pays the fee and who doesn't. The person who doesn't pay the fee is called the applicant. The applicant is generally the person coming to search for a property. And the client is invariably the seller who pays us our fee. So we always differentiate between applicant and client. Coming back to that, you have two relationships, one with the client, the person you're selling the property for. And although we get on very, very, very well with them and can become quite friendly, we have less of a relationship with them on a day-to-day basis and more of a relationship with the applicant, particularly when you're showing somebody property on a regular basis. So yes, we become quite friendly with the applicants, sometimes quite friendly with the clients, but probably we know the clients anyway, otherwise they wouldn't have come to us in the first place. But you can build a relationship. So, for example, there's an Indian family that we know extremely well, and I met when the father sold his business for quite a lot of money, 7 or 8 or 9 years ago, maybe longer than that. I know all the sons, I know the daughters-in-law. I've been to the children's weddings, and I'm extremely close. I don't do very much business with him. I did in the beginning, I don't anymore. But we become extremely close and very good friends.
Fantastic. Fantastic. I was interested, but I didn't know if there were limits to you know, clients remain strictly business and there's no kind of personal relationship.
It's very nice to be able to choose who one deals with. And generally, you choose people you deal with who you like. And I've always had an affinity to people, enjoy their company, enjoy their stories.
Yes.
And I try very much to spend time with them. Although nowadays I have children and grandchildren, I prefer to spend my weekends with my family rather than going out with clients.
Of course, of course. When mingling with the movers and shakers of the world, you must have come across plenty of chances and fraudsters. In fact, I read an amazing story of you showing a flat on Wilton Crescent, I think it was, to a man faking a Russian accent. You proceeded to report the man to the police, and upon his arrest, you found out that he was part of the gang that stole Tamar Eccleston's jewellery. Is that the most extreme story? Is it more common to have chances and fraudsters, or not really?
can't remember too many stories, but I remember a story of a man who at one point called himself Mr. Kodak, another point called himself Mr. Eastman, and he came to see a flat that we sold, we were selling in Grosvenor Square. In fact, I mentioned the Grosvenor Square flats at the beginning of this interview. He said, look, I just have to make sure that my artwork fits into the fact that I want to bring my artwork. But he didn't bring his artwork. He brought artwork from Sotheby's that he was probably doing the reverse story with. So that was one case. And then there was the son of a Scottish MP, whose name I remember absolutely perfectly, but I'm not going to mention it in this interview. We did exactly the same thing. So I think in my career, I can recollect three or four stories where we caught fraudsters out in microseconds.
And for the purpose of what? Why do you think they were doing what they were doing? Was it a case of kind of spotting them?
Well, for example, the chap on Wilton Crescent. First of all, I realized spontaneously that this is an improvised Russian accent. He was reversing words, trying to pretend with a bit of a guttural accent that that's how Russian speaks. The Russians speak. But what was, what crystallized the fact that he wasn't genuine was he only wanted to see homes that were developers' homes. He wanted to see homes where people lived in them. In other words, it's against the opposite of what people want today. People want to see brand new, unlived-in homes. Why would it? Could only be one reason. And as I said, he was caught having stolen some jewellery from an Eaton Square home that belonged to one of the Eccleston family.
Incredible. I want to jump back to kind of the success of Beecham. I've read you have a truly incredible work ethic. You work 5 days a week plus Sunday, 12 hours a day, 6 hours on a Sunday. When scaling Beecham, did you find it difficult to find people that had the same high standards as you did or not?
In the beginning?
Yes.
No. There were two or three people who I remember to this day and some of whom I still work with. Jeremy Davidson. Alan Russell, Anthony Lassman, Mark Pollack, Trevor Abramson. With the exception of Anthony Lassman, all are still around and all have the same high work ethic. They did that they had in those days, which they had in those days.
And with, am I right to say you have 9 offices around the world now?
I think we have a little bit more. We just signed a new lease on premises in Marbella yesterday.
Congratulations.
We are about to sign in Monte Carlo in the next couple of weeks. That gives us 5 in France, 1 in Spain is 6, 2 in London is 8, 1 in Mykonos is 9, 1 in Tel Aviv is 10. And an association in New York is 11.
Yes. And I suppose my question was that as the business has scaled, some of the previous guests we've had on have spoken about that kind of element of losing control and having to rely more and more on other people. Have you struggled with that at all or not?
I'm not allowed to do very much other than sell nowadays. So I don't do anything to do with marketing or legal or clients or anything else. We have a team, we have a legal department, we have a compliance department, we have a marketing department, rentals and sales. All I do is do my own sales and pass these inquiries on to others.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. When you know, potentially see a fantastic young estate agent coming up the ranks, what is it about them that really stands out, or does it vary person to person? What do you look for when hiring people?
I don't do any hiring anymore. Either head of sales does or a managing director does. But what one looks for is refinement, elegance, tenacity, appearance, knowledge of the market, confidence. Stature and appearance are very important. Confidence goes without saying, is probably one of the most important ingredients. Integrity and honesty are the top level of importance. I don't want somebody selling simply because they think they're the best salesperson. I want them to know the market. I want them to be straightforward and honest and correct. I want them to turn around to a seller and say, look, we've got an offer at X, but we don't think it's enough, and therefore we've refused it on your behalf. I don't want anybody pushing anybody into a position simply to earn their fees.
In fact, this was my next question, and I was gonna ask you that in a lot of interviews I've read that you make a point of stressing this word knowledge. You have 2.5 degrees, speak 7 or 8 languages, and seem to have interest in art and culture. Do you think it's this hunger for knowledge, as opposed to necessarily solely chasing the fee, that has built Beecham to where it is today?
Couldn't be. Have to think about that one. There's certainly a lot of hunger in me for many different things. And I like, for example, the other day I read about a new species of butterfly. And for the life of me, a week later, I'm looking for the article and I can't find the article. Googled it. I couldn't find the article anywhere. So yes, perhaps it is a desire to absorb as much knowledge as possible.
Mm. Mm. And then following on from that, I imagine that your motivations must have changed maybe multiple times throughout Beecham. Is that fair or not? You say now, for instance, you like to spend a lot more time with family as opposed to clients, etc. There must have been different stages of motivation,
wait,
desires.
Let's define work hours and then what I spend with my family. I work less, if not nothing, on a Sunday nowadays. And my weekends are pretty sacrosanct. I'll spend time with my wife, my children, and my grandchildren over the weekends, mainly with my wife and sometimes with some of my grandchildren. But during the week, I work extremely hard. I work extremely hard, and I don't want to miss anything. I've got FOMO, fear of missing out.
Yeah.
So perhaps that's what's driven me all my life.
Interesting.
I'm also, what's the expression? Tension, something, deficit disorder, whatever it might be.
Yes, ADHD. Yeah. ADHD. I'm going to go on to this. So you said in an interview, or in fact, let me take a step back. A former colleague has described you as a lunatic, but a phenomenal operator.
Who was that?
I don't know. I knew you would have asked me that, but I don't know.
I know it is. Tony Payne, Lonrez, 100% for sure.
You've said in an interview, some hate me, some think I'm not straightforward, abrasive, difficult to work with, but I'm as black and white as you get. Either people like me or they don't like me. I just say what I want to say. Do you recognize that you have a unique style, and have you embraced that? You know, it seems a far cry from the previous description of a shy young man.
Shy young man was when I was 18 or 19. I'm now 71, so do the maths. 52 years later. Thank God I've lost my shyness.
Fantastic.
And I can still be abrasive.
Fantastic. And actually, one more thing I was going to bring up with you, which is it goes back to something you said a few minutes ago, was you talk a lot about doing things the right and proper way. And I think potentially from an outsider's point of view, it's maybe not what people think about your industry. Do you think this right and proper way stems from faith, upbringing, values, the success you've already had?
I think it stems from all of the things you've just mentioned, but also watching colleagues of mine at Knight Frank, at Savills, at Hamptons, at Chesterton's in the early days, and who have maintained their positions at those sort of firms today, and how ethically they act. Mm. And I think in the world of a state agency, the only way to go forward is, besides the knowledge of the market, besides understanding the way people think, is to be absolutely correct. Mm. And I've learned a lot, not only from my own family, the way my father taught us, but from my colleagues in the industry.
Yes. Career highlights and some reflection. Most memorable deal, Avonfield House in the mid-80s? Tell me about that.
That's a long time ago. God, that's a long time ago.
I am going to get on to 2 to 8 Rollingate. 2
that's
to 8
a long
Rollingate.
Time ago. Avonfield House was a block on Park Lane, not a single block of flats, a block on Park Lane, where the two ends on the facing it, on the left-hand end was house on Park Lane. On the right-hand end, I think that's under the level of Park Lane, was a block of flats. And in the middle was Avonfield House. Wasn't an enormous deal. And a friend of mine, the late Ellie Khalil, asked me to help sell it. When it came to deducing title, it appeared that the house we were selling, which was 117 Park Lane, the far right, left-hand corner house, was encompassed in the entire 117 Avonfield House and 111 Park Lane. It was unsaleable. We had to do a deal with the Grosvenor where we gave the head lease back to the Grosvenor. We gave the freehold to Avonfield House. We managed to extract the freehold of 117 Park Lane and I sold it. It wasn't an enormous deal at the time. It was extremely complicated and gave me a lot of satisfaction of being able to release the parts of it.
And it wouldn't be right to not speak about 2 to 8 Rutlinggate, which, am I correct?
Why would it not be right? Because... Who wants to speak about it?
Was it the most valuable property deal ever, residential value, the highest residential value property deal in London ever?
I think if you look at the maths and you look at 225 million times the exchange rate in dollars, at the time the conversion rate was $305 or $310 million. I think it's probably a worldwide record for the sale of a single family house, let alone London. I think it was a worldwide record.
Yes, yeah. I think it would be right to speak about this quickly. So tell me about the excitement and the anticipation leading up to the transaction and also the publicity that followed after that.
It was a pie-in-the-sky transaction. Nobody ever thought it would go through. What happened was I was working with a man as chairman of a public company, managing director of a public company, who knows my children very well, has helped my daughter in business quite a lot. And they were buying residential schemes for redevelopment. Well, this Rutlinggate had two planning consents, one for a great number, one for a lesser number of flats. And took him over the building with his chairman. And I thought, this must be a fantastic deal for you. It's top end. Mike Spink has just sold flats next door at 7,000 pounds a square foot. In fact, we sold two of them. This stacks up. And Fairley said, no, it's not for me. Not for me. Absolutely not for me. But I've got a friend who might want to have a look at this. A few weeks later, three Range Rovers turn up. Four men on the duckboards of each Range Rover. It's a true story. Four men on the duckboards of each Range Rover. And they jumped out and the chat goes in. Building's completely stripped out. The Saudis have stripped the entire building out. So originally, it was a house of Prince Sultan bin Abdulaziz Al Saud. And it had the most amazing marble bathrooms and maquillage and marble floors and fully furnished and even gold tissue boxes in the bathrooms. It was, can't say ready to move into because it's slightly older, an older style, but actually bedrooms were in place, bathrooms were in place, etc. Ripped the whole lot out. Chat comes in, goes into the entrance hall. I think from memory, walked up the staircase to the first floor and then left. The next day, I get a call from the management director of the UK public company and says, said we want to buy it. And the rest is history.
Incredible. And the publicity that followed that, was it a kind of step change for Beecham or not really? By that stage, reputation had been built.
The publicity was not instigated by Beecham, by the seller or by the buyer. I know exactly who instigated the publicity, and it was unfortunately did so, very unfortunate, because publicity was instigated prior to completion of the sale. You can imagine such publicity comes out, maybe somebody would say, you know what, to hell with it, I'm dropping my deposit.
Yes.
Fortunately, they didn't.
Amazing. Absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible. Do you have any sense of the combined value of all the property you've sold in your career, or Beecham has sold?
No.
Not at all. In the many, many, many billions, I imagine.
I don't know, but I recently heard of figure being bandied about on the TV program of 5 odd billion in a career. Not that easy to work the number out, but I think over the years we've averaged, my firm, not me, but my firm has averaged close to £1 billion of sales a year.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible.
Can't tell you how many years that was fallen, but we've probably broken or just arrived at the £1 billion mark, rather, in terms of cumulative value of property.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Of all the places you could have lived in London, why Hampstead Garden Suburbs?
When my wife and I got married, I don't know, 13, 14 years ago, we wanted to have a house with a garden. And by chance, we found a little house in Hampstead Gardens. It's not enormous, but there's only two of us, and it's not on the main road. It's away from the main road. So you go into a little cul-de-sac, and then you walk down a path. So in front of us is another garden and another house. To the sides of us are gardens, and there's no cars in the area. You park your car before you get to the house. Completely silent. Completely silent. And we fell in love with it. We refurbished it and we lived there. We have an apartment in town. Initially, we decided we'll live in town for the week, during the course of the week, and spend weekends in Hampstead. And now, I don't know, we've spent a day in the apartment since last November.
For someone that deals with the super wealthy from across the world, does London still have the same pull as it might have done 10 years ago or not?
Does it have the same what?
The same attraction, the same pull to the city.
Well, you know what the government have done in terms of non-doms and everything else. So a lot of people are leaving. A lot of clients are phoning us up, old clients phoning us up and asking to sell their properties. A lot of them are leaving for safer tax havens. Might be Dubai, might be Singapore, might be Switzerland, they're leaving. So I don't know if it has the same attraction as it had beforehand. Certainly the beauty of the city and the aesthetics of the city are the same. The buzz of the city is the same. But remember, we've lost all the Russians, most of the Ukrainians. We're not getting, once upon a time, you know, there was a funny story I remember where a Russian told me, swore a friend of mine and a beautiful tie on. I've got the same tie. I asked him, how much do you pay for that tie? And he said, I paid £100 for the tie. I said, oh, I bought the same tie and I paid £200 for the tie. In other words, the more you spend, was the better it was. Well, those days have gone. So we've lost the Russians out. The Russians are no longer in the market. 500-600 are sanctioned. We do get Russians selling properties from time to time. We're selling one now slightly outside London. We looked at another one in Belgravia a couple of days ago. We're not getting any Russian buyers or very few Russian buyers. Getting some normal expat Russians who live here, trading, buying and selling, but that's about it. In terms of other nationalities, well, there are a lot of Middle Eastern buyers looking around, Indian buyers, and still some Chinese buyers looking for properties in prime central London.
Mm. And that if you were a gambling man, does that Russian money come back eventually or not? Is that gone for good?
Can't answer that question.
Okay. I hope you don't think too many of my questions have been silly, but my last one is a little bit silly. We've talked a lot about...
What's my name, Gary?
Yeah. Oh, we've talked a lot about houses, but I want to know what home means to you.
Home means homeliness. It means family. It means warmth. It means a place you can breathe and not be frightened, not be, and be totally relaxed. It's a place where you have all your loved ones and all your loved possessions.
Good answer. Gary, I want to thank you very much for doing this. I really, really do appreciate it.
A lot of fun.
Thank you very much.
Can I go now?
Of course you can.